I've entitled this particular message, Murphy's Law. I suspect that many of you are not aware that my dear wife Laura's maiden name is Murphy. If you go to the little town of Benbrook, although it's not so little anymore, you're bound eventually, if you stay there long enough, to meet a relative of Laura's. One of the things that is a bit of our or her family's lore is the perhaps unfortunate connection that they have to Murphy's Law. Murphy's Law, for the uninitiated, is a supposed law of nature expressed in various humorous popular sayings to the effect that anything that can go wrong will go wrong. This idea of Murphy's Law has led to all kinds of creative adaptations that speak to the application of the law. Here are just a few of hundreds that I found on the internet. There is the law of mechanical repair, and it reads, after your hands become coated with grease, your nose will begin to itch, and you'll have to go to the restroom. The law of gravity. Any tool, when dropped, will roll to the least accessible place. The law of probability. The probability of being watched is directly proportional to the stupidity of the act. Law of random numbers. If you dial a wrong number, you never get a busy signal, and someone always answers. There's Guy's variation rider that reads, if you change queues or traffic lines, or lanes, excuse me, the one you were in will always move faster than the one you're in now. And this also works in supermarkets and shops. The law of the bath. When the body is fully immersed in water, the telephone will ring. Degree of close encounters. The probability of meeting someone you know increases dramatically when you are the someone you don't want to be seen with. When you are with someone you don't want to be seen with. This is also the case if you are a female and you've gone out in the world with no makeup or wearing the worst clothes and have greasy hair. The law of biometrics. The severity of the itch is inversely proportional to the reach. The law of theater. At any event, the people whose seats are farthest from the aisle will arrive last. Murphy's law of lockers. If there are two people in a locker room, they will have adjacent lockers. The law of physical surfaces. The chances of an open-faced marmalade sandwich landing face down on the floor covering are directly correlated to the newness and the cost of the carpet. Brown's law of physical appearance. If the shoe fits, it's ugly. Wilson's law of commercial marketing strategy. As soon as you find a product that you really like, they will stop making it. And finally, the doctor's law. If you don't feel well, make an appointment to go to the doctor. By the time you get there, you will feel better. Don't make an appointment and you will stay sick. And then Will and Guy's law. If you don't save things on your computer, you will sooner rather than later delete them. How many of you found yourself thinking as I read those that, you know, these are supposed to be just funny little jokes, but my goodness, they sure line up with our experience. We have all experienced Murphy's Law, and Ecclesiastes chapter 10 could easily have been entitled Murphy's Law. Just look at some of the things that the preacher talks about. Verse 8 really stands out. Whoever digs a pit will fall into it, and whoever breaks through a wall will be bitten by a snake. In reading Ecclesiastes 10, I was immediately drawn to the old saying that by the venerable Scottish poet Robert Burns, and he penned this, "The best laid plans of mice and men." Actually, it's from a poem that Burns wrote about a mouse who has his nest destroyed by the poet. And the poet, in writing the poem, is trying to apologize to the mouse about what he has done to the poor mouse. And Burns points out that the destruction of the mouse's nest and so much more of our activity in life is subject to powers and events that we have no control over. Try our best to do the correct and the right thing, and it can just blow up in our faces. There's that old saying that I've been quoting a bit during this series, if you want to make God laugh, tell him your plans. Along the same line, I bet you didn't know until perhaps today that the expression a fly in the ointment comes from Ecclesiastes. All the elegance and the beauty and the tastiness and the pride of any project can be ruined by something as simple as and small as a fly. It's like all those awful jokes over the years about a patron in a restaurant who calls the waiter over and points out to the waiter that there's a fly in his soup. One of the best responses I ever heard to that joke is the waiter who says to the patron, "Please don't speak loudly, sir, or everybody will want one." Now, what was really interesting to me is that this little series of jokes is actually from something much, much older. It's from a series of stories and poems about the fly that fell into the soup, a soup that was cooking on a stove. It's from an old Greek fable recorded both, as I said, in verse and in prose. In the legend of the fly falls into the soup and begins as it was soaking there to reflect before it drowns. And it says to itself, "I have eaten, I have drunk, I have taken a bath. If I die, what do I care?" It is a philosophical fable that could have come right out of the book of Ecclesiastes. The preacher is like that fly in the soup. He ponders the futility of struggling against the fate that all people are heading for. There's nothing you can do about your impending death. So we might as well eat and enjoy life. Might as well not twist our brains in a knot trying to find some pattern to what is obviously the unfairness of life. The entire book of Job is designed to get us to think about the perceived unfairness we have when we look at life. In that book, Job's three friends come and they sit with him around a campfire to console him. And the trio are fully convinced that there must have been something Job did that have offended God and brought about this terrible calamity in his life. At the very end of the book, God finally speaks to Job, but he never answers the question to Job about why he suffered. Instead, God goes on to point out to Job that Job only sees a fraction of the reality around him. Job is therefore a fly in a soup. All through the series in Ecclesiastes, I've been presenting not only scriptural ideas to you, but also philosophical ideas. I remind you again that Ecclesiastes was almost certainly written as a teaching guide for the children of nobility. As wisdom literature, it was designed to provoke questions and a wrestling of our ideas about life. I've come to understand that the preacher has, in his writing, actually been describing a particular school of philosophical thought that years ago, when I was a student at the University of Guelph, I labored to understand. Although I took my degree in philosophy to complete my bachelor's, the reality was I understood very little about what I was actually reading and writing about. I was so confused most of the time just trying to make heads or tails out of these complex questions and ideas. To the end that I actually took to going to the on-campus coffee shop and I would buy senior or grad students a coffee just so they would take the time to explain some of it to me. The best part of my degree program was actually the many naps I garnered while I was trying to get through this stuff. One of the most unusual schools of thought that I ran across at the University of Guelph is called existential nihilism. An existential nihilism is the philosophical theory that life has no intrinsic meaning or value. With respect to the universe, existential nihilism suggests that a single human being, or even the entire human species, is insignificant, without purpose, and unlikely to change in the totality of its existence. We are all flies in the soup. According to the theory, each individual is an isolated being, born into this universe and barred from knowing why. This is also so much like the book of Job. The inherent meaninglessness of life is largely explored in this philosophical school of existentialism, where one can potentially create their own subjective meaning or purpose. Unfortunately, this branch of philosophy often leads, or almost always leads, to atheism. Many of those who write about existential nihilism are avowed atheists. In fact, I know of no philosophers or theologians who are Christian who are also nihilists. So what would we say about the preacher? Well, we know he's not an atheist. All through Ecclesiastes, the preacher attributes sovereignty of all things and over all things to God. Our preacher might say that, yes, God is sovereign, but we are not always kept in the loop about his plans. So in the face of the unpredictability of life, the preacher concludes that we must do the best we can. We should avoid laziness, according to verse 18. We should avoid gossip, according to verse 20. But most of all, we should avoid being a fool. Running through chapter 10 is the recognition that fools are easy to spot. They are like the fly in the ointment, spoiling things, and no matter how much wisdom they carry, it is meaningless with a little bit of wisdom that they carry. Also implied here is the advice that the preacher is giving is not rocket science. It should be obvious to us. Verse 10 reminds us that when you are doing a task, even if it's a menial one, the wise person prepares themselves for what lies ahead. In this case, if you're going to chop wood, you'd better sharpen your axe. Otherwise, you're going to work doubly hard for less result. I came across an apt illustration of this several years ago about a young man who was looking for work. And he approached a foreman who was running a logging crew, and he inquired about a job. "Well, let's see what you can do. Take down that tree," said the foreman. So the young man stepped forward and skillfully felled a great tree. The foreman was quite impressed and said, "You start Monday." And the week rolled by, and then on Thursday, the foreman approached the young man and said, "You can pick up your paycheck on the way out today." Well, startled, the young man said, "I thought you paid on Fridays." "Well, normally we do," answered the foreman, "but we're letting you go today because you have fallen behind. Our daily charts show that you dropped from first place on Monday to last place on Wednesday." "But I'm a hard worker," the young man replied. "I arrive first, I leave last, I've even worked through my coffee breaks." And the foreman, sensing the boy's integrity, thought for a moment and then asked him, "Have you been sharpening your axe?" And the young man replied, "Well, no, sir. I've been working too hard to take the time." I understand the enthusiasm and joy that comes from undertaking a project or getting into something that we really enjoy, but we still have to be prepared and we have to tread carefully. Preparation, safety, caution are all wise things that we must undertake in every task. We all know stories of someone who undertook some activity without adequate preparation, and they paid a terrible price. I know in my own life I've narrowly avoided a disaster or two by having acted too quickly and not being prepared. For example, one of my first adventures out at fishing at my brother-in-law's resort up in Spanish, I decided that morning that I would run my little boat and troll my line behind to see if I would catch anything. Almost immediately, I hooked into a very nice walleye, my favorite kind of fish. As I was bringing that walleye towards the boat, I realized that I had not brought a net. And no sooner had I realized that than the fish got off the hook. You see, I wasn't prepared. I catch so many nice fish that I now make sure, I catch so few nice fish that I always make sure that I have not one, but two nets in the boat ready to go. This lack of preparation is reminiscent of the Darwin Awards that I mentioned a few weeks back. You see, wisdom is not the exclusive purview of the rich or the powerful. The poor and the marginalized can also exercise wisdom just as the elites among us can exercise foolishness. Deciding whether someone is wise or foolish cannot be determined by how someone looks, whether they drive the best cars or who their friends are. There are countless stories of misjudging the ideas or opportunities that people are offering simply because we judge them and not their wisdom. Most of you have heard of Steve Jobs and maybe his associate Steve Wozniak. These two gentlemen helped create the personal computer called the Macintosh. Eventually, their company went on to be Apple. It is worth billions. It's one of the richest companies in the world. What most people don't know is that Jobs and Wozniak offered their invention to someone first, someone else. Jobs even talked about it in his own memoirs. He said, "So we went to Atari and said, hey, we've got this amazing thing, even built with some of your parts. What do you say about funding us? Or we could just give it to you. We just want to do it. Pay our salaries and we'll work for you." And they said, no. So they went to Hewlett-Packard and they said the very same thing. And they said, hey, we don't need you. You haven't got even through college yet. And history has proven how foolishness has trumped wisdom here in those two companies, and by underestimating these two very bright young men. Atari, for example, is no longer with us. The company went bankrupt, and Hewlett-Packard has struggled for years. The lesson the preacher is trying to impart to us is that we never know where wisdom is going to come from. Out of the mouths of babes, the psalmist wrote in Psalm 8. Even small children can express wisdom from their unique perspective. God can speak to our hearts from anyone, or even surprisingly, anything. One of the oddest stories in Scripture, at least in my mind, is in Numbers chapter 22. It's about a Moabite king named Balak, who was at war with the Israelites. And Balak was losing the war badly because there was a prophet named Balaam who was feeding the Israelites God-given information about where the Moabite troops were and how to defeat them. Well, Balak decided he was going to turn the tables on Israel. And so he sent a delegation, a significant number of men, to go and get Balaam. Balaam, who was an Israelite, was wanted by Balak because he wanted Balaam to go and curse the Israelites. Balak thought that if Balaam cursed the Israelites, surely the fortunes of war would turn in Balak's favor. God, though, repeatedly told Balaam not to go and meet with Balak, but Balaam decided to go anyway. Maybe there was money involved. On the way to that particular meeting, a sword-wielding angel appeared in his path, appearing not to Balaam, but to his donkey. The donkey, therefore, refused to go any further. Three times the donkey saw the angel and out of fear refused to travel any further. Because Balaam could not see the angel, three times he hit the beast terribly because it stopped. He struck the donkey three times and eventually even threatened the donkey's life. Do you know what happened next in the story? The donkey actually spoke to Balaam, chastising him for beating him. And Balaam's eyes were open, and he saw the angel, and he understood and therefore refused to go to Balak. Many years ago, according to Jerry White, there was a comic strip named Moon Mullins. I looked it up, and it was quite popular at one time. And Jerry says that his father, Chuck, used to read it to him every Sunday morning from the newspaper. And one of the main characters in that comic strip was a guy named Willie. In one strip, Jerry remembers, he was slumped in front of the television set with his coffee cup resting on his pot belly as he flicks his cigar ashes into the cup. He says to his wife, "You're awfully quiet this morning, Mammy." And she says in return, "Willie, I've decided to let your conscience be your guide on your day off." In the next scene, we find Willie surrounded by his lawnmower and an edger and a hoe and a shovel, and he's frantically washing the windows and muttering to himself, "Every time I listen to that dumb thing, I end up ruining my relaxing." We like to say, you and I, that we should let our conscience be our guide, but I trust that God is guiding my conscience. Maybe when we face a challenge or a struggle, God is trying to get our attention, to get us to change course or simply stop whatever it is we're doing. You see, in the end, we're not really under Murphy's Law. Instead, we are under the law of God's grace.